Good afternoon. We're going to call the State Affairs Committee meeting to order. It is 3:31 on Thursday, February 2nd. We're into the 2nd of February. Punxsutawney Phil, I think, has said there's going to be how many more weeks of winter? 6 weeks of winter? Okay. He knows. Let the record show we have a quorum to do business. Senator Egan, Senator Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Wilson, and myself, Senator Dunleavy, are present. We're going to be hearing an introduction of a bill today, SB 21. It is permanent fund income, POMV dividends. Prime sponsor is Senator Stedman. After the introduction of the bill and some questions, we'll lay the bill aside. We'll pick it up again probably very soon in the next meeting or two. And we'll continue those discussions. And then after the introduction of the bill and some questions, we'll have Dr. Ralph Thompson come up again, and we're going to go through a question and answer session on the economy, what certain taxes will do, reductions, et cetera, for the state of Alaska. So with that, Senator Stedman, if you can come forward, bring your staff if you so choose, state your name for the record, begin your testimony on your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Bert Stedman, representing the islands of Southeast. Just as when you look out the window, when you can't see anymore, that's where my district begins. Stops when you hit the Canadian border. With you today, we have a first reading on a bill that is very straightforward and very simple, and its goal is to basically protect the permanent fund. We have, and if I could, Mr. Chairman, I want to talk a little bit and set the stage a little bit with some of the background before I drop into the bill. The bill is, as the senators know, is very short, so it won't take me long when I get into the meat of it. But there's fellow Alaskans have varying degrees of background in business and finance and other things, and you know, some have stronger, some have weaker, and some have none. They are not around it, and they may be watching from home. But as we have struggled the last 2-3 years through our budget deficit, and we weren't fortunate enough to have increasing oil production and or increasing price this time to pull us out of this financial downturn, and we've slipped into a state where we've had a massive hemorrhaging of our savings. And we've all struggled hard several years ago and put away $16 billion outside of the permanent fund in two other savings accounts that we have been forced to deplete down to about 3.7 billion left. Now, that might sound like a lot, but when you have $2.8 billion in deficit, it is very small. So when, you know, over the last couple of years, when we have talked about how we're going to fix our situation through budget reductions or tax increases or, you know, oil price increases, whatever, the clock has ticked and our cash is burned, and we have the fortunate opportunity to be backstopped by the permanent fund that Alaskans have set away for several generations. It's about $56 billion. And we're also fortunate to be the owners of the largest conventional hydrocarbon basin in North America. And it's been very profitable for the state and our generations. When I look at Senator Giesel and myself and Senator Egan and Senator Coghill, all four of us were born in the territory of the state, and the other two senators here have been here for quite a few years themselves. And Senator Wilson, I'm not quite sure if you were born here or not. I haven't got to know you that well yet because you're a new senator. But regardless, it's, you know, we have lived through a huge wealth boom. And one of the most important things that we can do in public service, from my perspective, is protect that wealth that was created for future generations. It may be our grandkids and our grandkids' grandkids, Alaskans that aren't even here yet today, should be able to look back in the future at the oil wealth boom that we were fortunate enough, our generation, to fully participate in, and realize that we took pretty aggressive positions in tough times to ensure that that wealth would be transferred to their generation. So when that basin is depleted, and I think it's going to be decades into the future, but eventually it will get depleted in resources, they have a huge legacy to look back, and their ancestors were prudent enough to make sure that we didn't get in a half a decade or decade-long financial pinch and liquidate it. Also, with that being said, when you look at how to get out of this situation, get out of it meaning erase the deficit on a reoccurring basis, because a structural deficit will bankrupt the state or any other organization. So we want to get out of the structural deficit, get to a break-even, and preferably move beyond that into more profitable times. We need not only to make sure we protect the permanent fund for future generations, but we need to have some framework to bolt on other solutions. And those other solutions could be spending reductions, which we're all struggling with, all 60 of us in the legislature are struggling with, revenue enhancements or taxes, which we're all struggling with also, and or looking into the commodity markets and into our oil basin for improvements to get us out of this. But we need a framework to attach things to. My concern is that it is easier for us collectively to be backed into the permanent fund, into the earnings reserve. And for those watching at home, the permanent fund is protected by the Constitution, but their trading profits and dividends are not, unless we appropriate them to the corpus of the permanent fund, and which we have. Our predecessors in these positions have added about $7 billion to that. But there's still sizable amounts of money, and permanent fund directors here to speak more eloquently and with more authority on the permanent fund and its structure and its history and all that. So a lot of those type of questions I'd prefer to just have her take. But if we're going to ensure that we have a long-term asset for our children, frankly, we have to protect it from ourselves. We are the appropriators. The buck stops at the legislature, good or bad, and collectively we make the decision. So I've put forward a framework which I thought would be worthy of consideration of the Senate and hopefully beyond, and offer it up as a starting point and points of discussion to bolt onto. If we take a look at the permanent fund, and we talk about the structure of it, and this little joke was in the middle, was attached to my door the other day, so I decided that I'd just use it because I think it kind of points to it. I added a couple words. But when we look at the structure currently, and it's been a good structure, it's been very, very productive for the people. But I think it's time we take a hard look at it and make it more protective. Because right now, the way it is guarded, only the corpus, not the earnings reserve, is protected by the Constitution. The rest of it's 21 and 11 votes.
Question.
Sure.
So it may be semantics, but too often we hear the permanent fund, the ERA, and the PFD kind of used interchangeably.
Mm-hmm. And on the slide you say how to protect the permanent fund. It's already protected constitutionally. So what you're really talking about is the ERA again, and you mentioned that earlier, correct, Senator?
Correct. What I'm talking about is the entire $56 billion. That's roughly the value of it, $56 million. Right now we can access, and the permanent fund representatives here can probably give you a finer point on how much we can access. It's $7, $8, $9 billion without trading profits. There's assets they could hold that they could sell, and we could even spend more. My concern is the legislature, like the wolf in the little cartoon, which is us, including myself, it's all 60 of us collectively, end up cannibalizing the permanent fund, and as we work through this situation. So you're right, Mr. Chairman, there is the corpus that is protected. The earnings reserve is not from the Constitution, and this bill would take care of that. It would protect and limit the amount of appropriations that would come out of there. And how we do that, if I could, guard it from being raided, and we got the little Angela Riding Hood showing up at Grandma's house with the wolf, which is us, in the deficit, sitting there, and you know the old saying, oh my grandma, how big eyes you have, how big teeth you have, and the next thing you know, little Angela Riding Hood's in trouble. So we have, in this piece of legislation, looked at the different framework, and if we change our structure to take a look at the market value over a period of time for smoothing, basically take the let me back up for a second for just the people at home so it makes it easier to follow. If you take the portfolio at $56 billion and you say you're going to spend 10% of it a year, it's going to decline over time. Your savings are going to disappear. If you take it down to you're going to spend 8%, you're still going to have an erosion over time. This is something that a lot of us at our age start facing in retirement. How long will our retirement assets last? We want this asset to last forever. So as you take that payout down, at some point, your return on your portfolio starts to exceed your withdrawal, and you take it down even more, and it'll also exceed the erosion of purchasing power. So if you look around at history in the financial markets, and they're well documented back over 100 years, what has performed and what hasn't through different times, through wars and peace and bear markets and bull markets and the 08 recession and the 32 depression and all the data points we have. The numbers vary a little bit, but if you pull out 5%, 4.5%, 4%, 5.5% over that period of time, your assets will grow. There is times in where we have economic conditions like after World War II, where you have a huge build-out and strong growth, or in the 90s. We also have times like we have in 2008, where we have huge declines. So you've got to be able to balance both those out. But if you take a little bit out of your savings account every year, and do it, spend it, do what you're going to do with it, your savings will last, and you can, if you're at home, you could, you know, give that to your favorite charity or your children or what have you. So if we ring fence this permanent fund, say we're not going to access any more than in this bill 4.5% of the market value, so everybody can look it up in the newspaper, they know exactly what it is, pretty much, a little bit different because the permanent fund's a diversified portfolio, but there's no secret on what the market values are on any given day. And we say we won't spend any more than 4.5, period. That's it. There is no way the legislature then could go back in, and it may be us, or it may be the folks that follow us that are feel that they're in a fiscal pickle. It's easier to take huge chunks out and erode the value for the future generations. So if we limit that to 4.5, the permanent fund will grow, most likely in perpetuity. And it will inflation-proof itself because the asset returns will exceed the rate of inflation in the withdrawal on average. We will have, you know, recessions. Hopefully we don't have another depression like the 30s or another debacle like in 08 and 9. But we will have economic shocks. If I could stop there just for a second. I just finished 30 years in the financial markets and more or less retired here December 31st. Out of that 30 years, we had 10 economic shocks. We had the 87 Black Monday crash. We had the 2000 dot-com blast off or blowout. And then we had the 08, 09 recession. That's once a decade. That is not good odds. So there will be times in the future where the market value, even at 4.5%, might not exceed its or might exceed the rate of return. But with that being said, in the long run, it's unlikely. But if we limit that withdrawal, that will protect the permanent fund. We, the wolf here in the legislature, and I'm talking about myself included, all 60 of us, cannot get to it. Now, how do we deal with the dividend? We can take that 4.5% and we can spend, appropriate, I should say, it all to a dividend if we choose. That would not help us fix the problem we have today. And even if we, if I could just stop there for a second, my opinion, politically and professionally, is we cannot fix the situation we're in without the help of the permanent fund. I don't think it mathematically can be done. We cannot reduce the operating budget enough, and we cannot tax enough. So if we're forced into this, which in my opinion we are, how are we going to protect the permanent fund and be fair with the citizens on the dividends? So this bill proposes to not take 1 year of market returns, but take 5-year average. And what that'll do is smooth out the ripples in the financial markets. And to make it easier for the public and for the permanent fund and for the state, we back it up 1 year additionally. So it's 5 years of the preceding six. And what that does is when our budgets are done in the fall, they don't have to worry about the ending value of June 30th that summer. It's June 30th the summer before. So it makes the budgeting very accurate in the dollar amounts that could be calculated that the Department of Revenue would have, the governor and us. Okay. But with that being said, if we were to take that 5-year average, there won't be a lot of fluctuations year to year in the dividend or that total dollar stream. So then it comes down to a fairness issue and, frankly, some unfortunate and, I think, hard business decisions for us to make, because I never wanted to have to sit here in this position when I was an elected official and talk about having to spend the permanent fund. But that's not reality. So if we were, as this bill proposes, to split it 50-50, the 4.5% with the public, we take one half of it and we give it to the people. It's their money, so we're not really giving it to them, but they're, you know, we would have a minimum of 2.25% of that market value, or one half of the amount we appropriate would go to the dividend checks. Then that other one half or 2.25%, we'd have that discussion in the legislature. What do we do with it? Do we need it for our operating budget? Do we need it for schools? It's going to be core services, because I don't think the public's going to put up with non-core services, personally. Do we need it for schools? Do we need it to run our troopers, you know, what's going on? Or do we take that other 2.25% and put it back to the permanent fund? Say, hypothetically, things are great. The economy's roaring. Our oil basin's cooking along. Our budgets are balanced. We could take that other 2.25% or 1/2 of it and add it to the dividend if we wanted, or send it back to the permanent fund so they could grow it and we could even get more money out in the future. And I think there'd be a lot of Alaskans that would take that opportunity pretty serious to have a little less today for more tomorrow. But we could, and in the next several years, I think it's economic reality, be put in a position where we're going to have to take that 0.5% or 0.5% of it, 2.25%, to the general fund to meet our obligations. I think by structuring in that way, where the citizens get a dividend of 2.25% of the market value every year, and then if they don't get the other 2.25%, we're going to have to go back to the district and explain to them why their dividend is the size it is and why we took, you know, whatever amount it was in the reduction, and either sent it back to the permanent fund or brought it into to the general fund. And that would not be a spending cap. So don't get confused with the conversation in the building of the spending cap. This is not a spending cap, Mr. Chairman. But it does do exert downward pressure on the appropriating body, us. Because every summer they're going to want to know about their dividends and why the amount is it is, and it would be at the finance table and both bodies and signed by the governor. So although I, you know, the I guess the cartoon tries to put a little bit of humor on it, it really hits the mark. I'm personally concerned that we're going to get ourselves into a position where there may be enough of us in the legislature that want to appropriate out of that earnings reserve account in the tune of billions the next couple of years, and we can't replace it. So we have the permanent fund is supposed to be permanent savings account. And these are some statutes for those online that like to look up things, and needs to be prudently managed. And we've done all this, and we're currently doing this today, and we're supposed to maximize the purchasing power over time. So we're not going to change any of this stuff. The permanent fund returns over time vary with economic conditions and portfolio allocations, and the permanent fund, Angela Rydell is here, she could speak to this stuff. I think she'd be a better messenger than myself on the intricacies of the permanent fund and returns. They're forward-looking returns, how comfortable they are at 4.5%, and that other structural items. So I just have one slide on the returns. And the structure that I just spoke about is basically laid out here. So this is the bill. It's hard to read that the red, but it basically limits the amount that the government can take. It basically closes the door. We would not have we would not have the ability to appropriate over 4.5% out of the permanent fund. So we, the legislature, would have to take it pretty serious when we have a financial downturn, because we're not going to have an earnings reserve to draw to. We can, in the future, build up our CBR, our Constitutional Budget Reserve, our Statutory Budget Reserve, our other savings accounts outside the permanent fund if we so choose, which we probably will for a cushion, build those up. But the permanent fund would be taken out of the discussion as a, you know, an absolute fallback of unlimited proportions, so we don't have to respond to deficits and swinging economic conditions. This would force the legislature to act. The again, the maximum that could go to state government or back to the permanent fund would be 2.25%. The minimum dividend check would be 2.25%. And the maximum payout total impact to the permanent fund would be 4.5% on a 5-year average. And if we, and that makes it pretty smooth. These are fairly common. If I could just kind of break a little bit out of this for a little bit of history, Sitka, a little over 20 years ago, switched their little permanent fund from all bonds to a market value approach like this, commonly referred to as a percent of market value. And they pay out 6% a year to their general fund. And I've sat on the a review committee with that and helped them structure that, from the initial idea, right, through writing the ordinances and on down the line. And I could tell you through personal experience and personal and professional experience, 6% is too high. We've seen a slow erosion of purchasing power slightly over there in Sitka over the last 22 some odd years, maybe it's pushing 25 now. But we went through the 2000 interruption in the markets along with 2008 and 2009. There's no magic with 4.5%, but I can tell you 6% is too high. And if you go down to 2% as an example, you don't draw enough, can't get to enough funds to fix the problems that were faced, and the dividend amounts come down substantially. So that'll be the what I'm trying to put on the table is a framework. And with discussions with the permanent fund, the finance committee, legislative finance, and all the experts, to have us collectively come up with the meets and bounds on this. What does it mean to the guy at home sitting there listening to this politician talk, not saying anything? I want to see how many dollars are coming to my pocket. I did not approach this problem with that concept on the table. This wasn't driven by how much your dividend should be. It was driven by what structure should we have to protect the permanent fund, number one. Then if we have the structure and we split the structure 50-50, what's the dividend to the public? Somewhere in the range of around $1,700 in 2018. That's $1,700. That would give us, that's a total of about $1 billion. You can see it up there in the third column over, the minimum dividend of 2.25. That would give the, if we appropriated, which is highly likely, the other remaining one half to the general fund, that would be $1,089,000,000, or rounded off to $1,001,000,000. I think in reality, just the public listening, before they get their deposit slip and run to the bank, we're faced with a situation so grave that we're going to have to phase this in. Because I think when we have discussions with the Department of Revenue, they may need more help to make their payroll for a couple of years. So I'm not as concerned if it takes us a couple of years to get there. My concern is that we get there, that at the end of the day, we have blocked the ability of the legislature to access over 4.5%, and the public gets a fair dividend and a fair split and a fair shake for the assets they own, and this portfolio or this wealth, wealth portfolio that's been created over the last several decades continue for future generations. So the $1,700 is a 50-50 split. I know I've talked to some people that think that number is too big. Some people think it's too small. Again, this was focused on how to protect the permanent fund and give the public an appropriate dividend, because again, it's their money, not ours. We're just the overseers. So SB 21, I like to call it 2017 because there's other bills running around that some will get confused. helps close the fiscal gap. It gives us a framework to bolt on other tools as we see fit, which will have to be added. Helps keep downward pressure on government spending. And one of the tools is the spending cap that's been worked on by the chairman and others that will be coming out. There's budget reductions discussions underway, revenue enhancements of previous committee here underway with fuel and other things. But we need a framework, and we need to have the public support what we do. And if we share the stream of wealth coming off the permanent fund, number one, protect it. Number two, share it. Have a structure where the public shares it with the general fund, where we can meet our education objectives and obligations and public safety and have the money to run DNR, I think we'll have public support. And if we don't have public support, we can have the greatest ideas and vote them across, and the public either throws the bums out, puts a new set in, changes it, or barks at us so much we change it ourselves. And we need to have stability and predictability. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to remind the public that the presenter is one of the wolves. There's 60 of us total. We have good intentions. Collectively, we are very dangerous when there's a pot of money in front of us. And we have the biggest stack of billions relative to the amount of people in the state that any state can't even imagine our wealth. They're shocked at it. And I just want to make sure when my descendants look back at the line of Stedmans, and I'm the fourth one born, my daughter's the third one born here, and it goes back to before territory days, possession days, that those that were fortunate enough on the timeline of life to be here during the wealth bubble were prudent enough to pass it forward to the next generations of Alaskans. That's the focus, and we'll just have to suck it up and deal with the deficit and not to destroy our kids' future while we do it.
Thank you, Senator. We're going to take questions maybe for about 5 minutes and lay aside so folks can think about it and have more questions and bring you back here very shortly. Some of us like to see ourselves as actually the wolf hunters. They actually go after the wolves to make sure they don't kill little Angela Riding Hood. Question. Your focus seems to be on protecting the fund, and I get it now. The ERA is a portal to the permanent fund. If you draw too much in the ERA, you reduce the permanent fund. Why not propose this as a constitutional amendment to make sure that future wolf packs can't get into it through, because it's a bill. It could be changed with future legislators.
That is very, very true, Mr. Chairman, and I thought about that, and it came down to public support. And if the public doesn't support it, whatever solution we have, it won't stick. So I thought it would be better to start it as a statutory change. And for those at home, what that means in English is the next legislature can just change it. 21 and 11 votes can just do what they want.
Well, how does that protect it?
If the public supports this concept, which I think they will when they realize how defensive it is of the permanent fund and how it doesn't change the permanent fund structure, it doesn't put the permanent fund at risk of being raided and actually closes the door and walls it shut, I think they're going to be very receptive to a constitutional amendment, and I'd like personally to see one.
So you would support a constitutional amendment?
For this, yes.
Concept?
Yes.
And the only reason I'm asking is, We've had in statute for decades a calculated payout for the permanent fund dividend, which was vetoed this past year.
Correct.
And so, if it's not constitutionalized, the wolves, one form or another, can monkey with it. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering why you initially did not advocate for this to be a constitutional amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good point. It's a point of timing. I'd like to see the public support whatever framework we put forward in the legislature. I think this is a cornerstone of it. I'm hoping that the public, once they see how straightforward it is, there's no smoke and mirrors, there's no, you know, if this goes up, your dividend goes up, you know, as far as other things going into it. It's just straight, like an endowment portfolio. I think they'll support and want a constitutional amendment to keep the wolves, us, out, because the next several years are going to be tough years in the legislature for appropriating enough funds to make our payroll, because we are unable to make payroll, and that is a serious matter. You know, when we have the future meetings here, Mr. Chairman, I hope the permanent fund will come in and have some conversations of how they're structured, what they think of it, good, bad, and otherwise, and we start working through some of the intricacies. And after that conversation, if we can agree on a tight framework to protect the permanent fund, we'll have to have a conversation with revenue on how we transition from where we're at, because quite frankly, there's more than one wolf looking at that pot of money at the permanent fund.
Questions from members of the committee? We're going to take a few questions, but then we're going to stop so we can give Mr. Townsend an opportunity. Questions? I have another question. Earlier you said it's the people's money, and you were referring to the dividend. Mm-hmm. Just have to ask the question. Do you support SB 1 and 2, which would return the vetoed portion of the dividend to the people of Alaska? I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. You do believe it's the people's money?
There's no doubt. Okay. Not only is it the people's money, it's the people's oil. It's the people's gas, people's fish, bear, deer. And we are a state, unlike all other states, it's owned in commons. We are not Texas. We don't have the Ewing's Ranch on top of us. Of an oil well. We collectively own it.
I look forward to your support on those bills. Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Stedman? Senator Giesel.
You know, this might be a question for the director of the permanent fund. Might be a question for the director of the permanent fund, but there was another proposal last year that actually took a higher percentage from the earnings reserve account. How would this lower percentage change how the fund was managed? I mean, this might be, can you answer that or have a thought on it?
It would be better if the director answered that, because she's speaking from authority. It would be better to have, I'd like to silo those questions.
Director, could you come forward, please, state your name for the record. We're gonna go maybe about five more minutes. Senator Egan has a question before.
Mr. Chair, it's not a question. It's just a compliment to Senator Stedman, believe it or not. If you would have done what you did, or we did, in an old finance committee and infused $12 billion into the CBR, we wouldn't be talking now. We'd be done. We'd be trying to figure out something entirely different, and it would really not be pretty. So I want to thank you.
If I can comment on that just a minute.
Sure, Senator Stedman.
It's all about timing. I'm trying to get public support. I wish in retrospect we would have taken some of those massive savings and billions and put them to the permanent fund, even with the current structure, slipped them off the table. None of us expected to have this big of an economic downdraft. We knew downdrafts come. But this has been a doozy for the state. So it caught a lot of us by surprise, I think.
Thank you. Director Rodell, please state your name for the record, and then Senator Giesel is going to ask you a question.
Sure. For the record, I'm Angela Rodell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. The Senator, through the chair, the management of the fund under the proposed legislation probably would not change. What's going to drive changes to the management of the earnings reserve account as a result of any legislation that might come forward is going to be the liquidity demands and how quickly we see that earnings reserve getting drawn down and the expectation. I think one of the things that is helpful in all of the pieces of legislation, including the senators, is that there is this lag, so we're walking into a fixed dollar amount into the budgetary season. So there is not an expectation of expected earnings or an unknown amount that may crop up in any of them. So the more certainty we can have on the expected draws and what those draws will be, because due to the lags and the percentages, the better able we will be able to manage. Now, the higher the percentage draws, the more we will have to look at the risk profile of the earnings reserve account to make sure that we have that higher dollar amount available that you're expecting to be available for budgets.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? We're going to have plenty here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator Calcio.
Just one last thing. The Senator made it sound like the evaluation process would be pretty straightforward. Can you confirm that? Is it because I know there's a lot of dynamics in your asset allocation, but would it be as easy as that to have a kind of a continuous valuation that would say this is the 100%, and by the way, only 4.5% can come from that?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, this is a very straightforward, and it complies with all of the issues we have. As you know, the Constitution is written that the income is what's available for spending, and so this continues to recognize the challenges we have between generally accepted accounting principles and what we can make available for spending balances. So this is a very straightforward calculation for us.
Senator Giesel.
One last question. Director Rodell, this proposal would make available for spending by government of, as the Senator said, about $1.1 billion. The Senate Bill 128, 130, whatever it was we passed last night, I can't remember the number. How much would that have made available? Do you recall?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I don't remember off the top of my head what that amount was, but I don't remember.
Oh, thank you. I'll look it up. Thanks.
Additional questions? Seeing none, we're going to lay the bill aside. Executive Director, is that the proper title? We're probably going to ask you back for you and or whoever staff you want to bring with you for discussion, since this involves the permanent fund. But with that, we're going to lay it to the side. We're going to generate questions. I'm sure we'll be talking to Senator Stedman and others, and then we will quickly bring this bill up again for further discussion and questions. Okay? Thank you. We're going to take a quick at ease and transition out and have Dr. Townsend come up. We're back in session. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee, and before us we have Dr. Ralph Townsend with ICER, associate with the University of Alaska Anchorage. Dr. Townsend is an economist. We had him here a couple weeks ago talking to us about the economic situation that the fiscal situation may have on the state of Alaska. And we've asked Dr. Townsend to come back to be able to answer and ask some detailed questions and get us some more answers on various revenue measures, cuts, impact of the PFD, and behaviors associated with some of these actions. So, Dr. Townsend, if you could state your name for the record, we'll begin asking you some questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate being invited back. I'm Ralph Townsend. I'm the director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research. Again, representing myself in terms of the opinions, but I'm very pleased that the University of Alaska has been able to give ICER the necessary resources to continue to serve the people of Alaska, including the legislature. If you'd indulge me, I actually put together a couple of slides in anticipation of questions, and I'm going to choose the first one simply because it actually follows on to the comments made by Senator Stedman. What do I need for a button here?
Brief at ease. It's okay. We'll get this worked. Okay, we're back in session. Please continue, Dr. Thompson.
One of the disadvantages of having these sessions videotaped is that my staff watch them and see what I have to say and give me feedback. And they were generally polite about it. After all, they do work for me. But a couple of them made what I thought was a really good point, and to some extent it follows up on Senator Stedman's point, and that is, if we think about the current fiscal challenges facing the state, a good first step is to say, actually what's going on is the legislature is helping the people manage four major assets that we have. And one of those is obviously the oil and gas resources. The second one is the financial assets in the form of the permanent fund, the earnings reserve, et cetera. There are, however, two other assets that are also part of the management decisions. One is the physical infrastructure that the state has invested in heavily. It's a very substantial investment. And our last one, and one that we sometimes leave off, but is really vitally important to the future of the state, is human capital. That is, we make investments in our people in the form of education, but we also make investments in institutions. So, for example, we create court systems and we find the resources to define a court system. And if we had to invent a court system from scratch right now, we'd probably have difficulty getting to a court system that functions the way the one that's up and running is. So these are four assets that the legislature, there are other assets, but these are big major parts of what we're thinking about. And for a long time, for the state, looking at the first two assets, the oil and gas reserves were a very large asset and dwarfed, for example, the financial assets. And the strategy for that period was fairly straightforward. We took resources from the oil and gas reserves as they were being used up, and we put them into financial assets. In the really good years, we put them into physical infrastructure, and we made more or less continuous investments in human capital, in education, healthcare, and those kinds of things. And that wasn't an especially difficult decision process, because moving assets from oil and gas reserves into the other ones were sort of obvious decisions to make. And again, we used both the financial assets and the physical infrastructure in a certain sense to balance out the ups and downs. If oil revenues were really down, then we didn't put as much in the financial assets, we didn't put as much in the fiscal infrastructure, and when we had large amounts of money coming in from oil, then we did invest in those. What we missed is that over time, there's been a significant shift in the relative importance of these assets. The oil and gas reserves are now much less valuable, in a present value sense, what they're going to yield in the future. The oil and gas resources are much less valuable than they were initially. Depending on your interest rates and assumptions about new discoveries and so forth, you're going to get an answer that financial assets today, that is the permanent fund and its associated reserves, are probably larger in present value sense than the oil and gas that remains to be, the revenues the state will get from oil and gas looking into the future. And because the state has invested substantially in physical infrastructure, both roads, airports, buildings, and so forth, those assets are also substantially increased. So that today, the assets, the financial assets, the physical infrastructure, are a much bigger part of the management issue. And that gives really a couple of problems that we didn't see, and unfortunately, the 2015 downturn kind of emphasized for us, and that is that we needed to manage these collectively to somehow smooth out the in the past, the variation was fairly straightforward. We didn't take as much and put it in the financial assets and the fiscal infrastructure. When earnings were down, when earnings were good, we put it in. That was a straightforward rule. And by the way, the legislature and the people of Alaska, I think, deserve a great deal of credit, as Senator Egan indicated earlier, for making the decisions not to spend at all, but to invest it in both fiscal infrastructure and the permanent fund. But that change that really was highlighted in 2015, in fact, has been a long time coming. The slow decline in the oil production was masked to some extent by the high oil prices. And so now the issue going ahead is exactly the kinds of issues related to Senator Stedman's bill, that is, how do we manage those financial assets we have, and how does the investment in those financial assets interact with both oil and gas revenues, which are going to continue to go up and down, and with our decisions with respect to fiscal infrastructure and human capital. So I think thinking about it that way tells us that 2015 wasn't this dramatic turning point. It unfortunately highlighted a long-term trend, and despite the fact of having in the budget reserve enough funds to handle 3 or 4 years, the truth was that the world was changing to a greater extent than we had realized and planned for. And so the challenge for us is managing these assets together going ahead, rather than worrying about managing any one of them or the simple question of closing this year's budget gap. And I thought that was a good point on the part of my staff, that this shift in the nature of our asset management problem is changing is a useful way to understand the bigger picture as opposed to what's this year's fiscal crisis. So with that, I'm happy to turn to questions.
Questions from members of the committee. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Townsend, earlier in your presentation that you made when you first came, you talked about how if we continue our capital budget at the current levels, we won't be able to support our infrastructure in later years. Do you have an idea of a percentage of our budget or a number that you can imagine to have a level of sustainability for our capital infrastructure in the state?
I really don't have the background to provide you with a number that says we need to do $200, $300, $500 million. I simply don't have sufficient background, and I haven't really sat down and looked at what our infrastructure investment looks like. I do think that it's fairly clear that the amount we're putting in right now, which is basically $100 million to match the federal match, it would not keep up with the large infrastructure that we have if that's all we did for a long period of time. That it's got to be something in the, you know, in the least small hundreds of millions of dollars if we're going to support the buildings, ports, airports, those kinds of things. I would say that in all likelihood, the state will want to at least consider funding its infrastructure much the same way as the other 48 states or 49 states fund it, and that is relying on the fact that states have a favorable access to capital and bonding many of the longer-term infrastructure projects. And that's because state interest is tax deductible. States have access to capital at a lower interest rate than the private sector does, and most states support their highway construction, their fiscal building construction, not entirely from the operating budget, which obviously has been the way Alaska has done it for a long time.
Thank you,
Dr. Townsend. Have you taken a look at Alaska's indebtedness?
No, I've not.
Just a suggestion, if you have time and you can't sleep at night, you may want to take a look at that. Because that may help you with the what you just said earlier about the idea of bonding. I think that's going to be crucial, because I think many of us hope to have a continued dialogue with you. So you don't want to look at the indebtedness of the state of Alaska as well. I think that's going to be an eye-opener and may actually play into some future discussions as to what we can do and what we can't do. And again, what many of us are really interested in, I mean, I am especially, is what do some of these actions, how do some of these actions manifest themselves in behaviors? In other words, if we take this action, what's the behavior over here that would occur, human behavior? Do people leave the state? And if so, to what degree? Do they not want to invest in the state? Do they spend less? How does it impact? Because I think there's a belief that we can keep the party going as was. All we have to do is just, you know, ante up. Some of us, though, question whether we can keep the party going as it was, even if we ante up. And the part about the anteing up is, what does it do to human behavior? Do people leave? Is Alaska in a situation where if there is an income tax imposed, and to what level will people leave the state? Or a property tax? Or a sales tax? Obviously, if we reduce the size of government, there will be people that will either have to shift jobs or would be unemployed. What would happen to those folks? How would that impact, for example, potentially assistance programs until those folks transition? So these are some of the things that I think myself and others are interested in, because we have to make some decisions here pretty soon. And we want the best advice, best data, best research possible as we go down this road. Many folks right now are saying, income tax, that'll help us, that'll save us. Well, to what degree? How does that look? What does it look like? What does it do with? What does it do for people? What does it do to people, et cetera? So can you talk to us a little bit from your research what you find when involving income taxes or sales taxes or property taxes or reductions? What can we expect in terms of ramifications of those decisions or a combination of?
It's a very broad question,
yep.
Senator. Let me start with first a high-level answer that I think is important to keep in mind, and that is that when you're talking about the kinds of decisions you're talking about, leaving the state, investing in the state, and so forth, those are long-term decisions. For a few people at the margin, it may make some very small differences, but basically these kinds of decisions to build a new plant or not build a new plant, these are pretty long. People are not looking at this year's budget to figure that out. They're looking at what's going to be my situation over the next 5 to 10 years. And so that comes back to a point I made when I was here a week ago, which was an important piece of providing people with the ability to plan for their futures is indeed to have the outline of where we're going, not necessarily to implement all of it, but to understand what are going to be the kinds of changes that we make, whether they're reduced services or increased income taxes or increased property taxes. All of these have implications for all kinds of decision makers, both businesses and private individuals. And it's the situation we don't want to be in, where everybody essentially fears the worst. Someone says, if you do an income tax, I know I'm going to be hurt. If you do a sales tax, you know I'm going to be hurt. If I increase property taxes because there's been a change in the way aid to education is structured, I know that's going to affect my business that has a large plant in some community. What you don't want is everybody thinking, oh, these bad things could happen to me, when in fact only a subset of them are going to occur. Likewise, in terms of looking at the kinds of changes that we may need to make in delivering services, for example, that making plans over time about where we're going will help us both make the adjustments in a reasonable way, but also help the clients we serve. And an example of that, the university, and I'm not trying to put forward self-interest here, but pointing out the university has proposed a specific plan about where it sees the decline in budget taking it in terms of its tuition relative to tuition for the other Wichita states. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that allows institutions to adjust and say, where will we be, how will we be different, and what will be the kinds of adjustments that we need to make to accommodate that. So I think that high-level issue of identifying how we're going to solve various aspects of what's a big, complicated problem is important to helping people make better decisions, including in the short run deciding to invest in Alaska. In terms of the impacts, when I was the presentation that Professor Katabi made to Labor and Commerce, and which I summarized last week, it's not so difficult to predict what will be the short-run impacts of sales taxes, income taxes, changes to the dividend, or various kinds of cuts to government. And I presented those. I'd be happy to go through them again, but pretty much what those say. In the short run, taxes are very similar in their impact, because the short run impact of taxes is to take money out of people's pockets. Different taxes take it out of different people's pockets, but the total amount being taken out is about the same, and the impact is about the same. There are differences, but they're well within the margin of error. You know, that if you're talking about 3% differences in projected job losses for an income tax versus a sales tax, we're not telling you that our numbers are that precise. So the general, those numbers, and again, if it's useful to put them up, I've got them on the computer, but for taxes, the short-run impact is going to be very similar, whether it's an income tax, a sales tax, increases in the property tax. The modeling we do says that the impact of a cut to the dividend, of a $100 million reduction to the dividend, is a little worse. And the reason for that is straightforward. That is, sales taxes and income taxes, by their nature, are not evenly distributed. People with more money pay more sales taxes. People with more income pay more income taxes. The dividend, as you know, is evenly distributed in terms of per capita. So more of it goes to people who are at the lowest end of the income distribution, or relatively more of it compared to taxes, is an impact on people at the lower end who tend to spend all of their income.
How do you define, Dr., short-term in terms of duration? Years, months?
I think when you think of economists use these words, and we tell our students they're terms of art, sort of thing. And that's a polite way of saying we don't want to answer the question, of course. The short run is when the obvious impacts are being played out. So if you cut income, people spend less, right? If you cut the, and let me say that when I say it's where the direct effects are felt, well, it depends upon the nature of the action. If you cut the PFD, there's an immediate, quite an immediate impact on a number of people. The spending, the PFD is not something, most of the PFD is spent in a relatively short period of time. If you cut the capital budget, of course, the short run is quite a long period of time, because the capital budget is not all, the direct impacts are all not felt in the first year. They're actually felt over perhaps as long as 5 or 6 years. So for capital changes, the short run would be quite a long period of time. And we've seen that the construction budgets did not, or the construction employment did not fall immediately with the reductions in the state capital budget. The long run is the period in which people have made all their adjustments. They've both made their short-term adjustments, but they've also made the kinds of adjustments you're alluding to. They've decided, I've decided to leave Alaska, would be the example that you've chosen. Or I've decided to, given that property taxes are higher in my business, I have decided to resize the size of my company, which I can't do. You know, I've got a building, I can't change it this year. But when I get around to making decisions as we adjust the size of my company and what it does over 10 years, perhaps I can make decisions about what's the infrastructure I need for my company and where am I going to put it. So that would be the distinction. I would say most of the time when you think about the short run, you know, it's typically a year or two. But for things like the capital budget, it's clearly longer. On the other hand, when you think about the long run, it certainly takes these changes 5 years to work through the economy, and in many cases longer than that.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, you touched on it briefly, but the numbers from your last presentation that you gave us last Saturday about jobs were really interesting, but the ones about 100 million in cuts compares to 100 million from one tax to another. And I shared that slide with a bunch of my constituents, and I represent a lot of public sector employees, both municipal and state, and then, of course, many private sector. And one of them asked me if we had done any research on how different options hit different families. And give you an example. You have a mom, a dad, two kids. Which taxes are better or worse for them? Do you have any idea?
Well, Well, there's...
Or have you even thought?
There's been a great deal of research done in the U.S. over which taxes are regressive and which taxes are progressive. And we can fall back on that. Alaska's not different. The one thing that Alaska has that is different is Alaska has the permanent fund dividend, mm-hmm. and so we have to do our own research with respect to the permanent fund dividend. ICER has done some work there, and we're pretty sure, and again, we're not only pretty sure, but it's very logical, that in terms of its impact, the nature of the permanent fund is it's distributed the same dollar amount to everyone. And so as a percentage of income, the permanent fund dividend represents a much larger share of somebody earning $10,000 than it does of somebody earning $100,000. So there seems to be little doubt that in terms of the immediate options, in terms of tax cuts versus the dividend has a more negative impact on lower income people. And so an economist would say that that it would have a more aggressive impact. Sales taxes. Now, I know last week you had Jared Walczak in to talk with you about a number of features of the sales tax in particular, and he raised a whole bunch of points that I thought were really informative in terms of letting you know what's going on in other states. But I think he and I would tell you that the evidence is fairly clear that a sales tax, by its nature, is somewhat more regressive than a flat income tax. And, of course, with an income tax, you can make it essentially as progressive, well, within the limits of people continuing to earn income, but you can make a progressive tax more or less progressive. And as you make it more progressive, then the impact becomes more focused on upper-income individuals. And that's one of the reasons why people who are very concerned about the equity of the tax structure, of course, favor an income tax, because mm-hmm. they can... You know, you can change the rates to achieve the goal you're trying to achieve, whereas with the sales tax, it's really inherent in the nature of a sales tax that a sales tax will be somewhat regressive. The question is how much, and I think as Mr. Walczak indicated, it depends on what the breadth of it is. Why does the sales tax have to be regressive? Well, because people at the lower end of the distribution spend more of their income than people at the upper end. People at the upper end have the option of saving, and they do save, and they save very significant amounts. People who are earning $20,000 a year spend most of their income, and therefore, in a percentage terms, are going to be more impacted by the sales tax. As I indicated last week, the property tax is the one where a great deal of academic blood has been spilled about whether it's regressive or progressive, and that's because the property tax, remember, is not... We tend to think of it, oh, it's paid by residents, but of course the property tax is substantially paid by corporations in the form of taxes on commercial and industrial property. And there it is difficult to tease it out. There are effects of the property tax. People on fixed incomes, as gets a lot of attention, tend to be adversely affected. The elderly who live in their home that they've lived all their lives will pay a relatively larger percentage. And not surprisingly, many jurisdictions try to deal with that particular feature of a property tax by various kinds of circuit breakers. I might ask Mr. Chairman if that addresses the Senator's question.
Yes, thank you.
Senator
thank
Giesel.
You, Mr. Chair.
Senator Giesel?
So, Dr. Townsend, a few minutes ago, you made the statement about the importance of making changes over time to allow people to plan for adjustments. And so I want to ask you about a significant issue that we're dealing with that actually has become a sudden imposition of what I would call a tax. And that is the tax credit program that the state of Alaska has for the oil and gas industry. So we have in place, a tax credit program that the legislature has traditionally funded, right? And so now we find ourselves in this fiscal challenging time. And the companies that were promised these tax credits are new entrants into Alaska. So you could
in my mind, I think of them as a lower-income family, right? They didn't have the assets themselves to start work up here. We said, look, we'll backfill you, right? So the governor vetoed those, and suddenly the loans that they had with banks in the lower 48, Bank of America, ING, Apollo, suddenly those loans are coming due. The companies can't even pay the interest on it. It is analogous to us, government, suddenly imposing a tax. And it's causing quite a stir, quite a credibility gap for the state in terms of the credibility of our word. Now, on the one hand, it could be argued that government inserted itself into what was otherwise a free market and distorted that market by promising these credits and then suddenly pulling out. But regardless, we have a promise made, and we have not paid that promise. How do you see this issue? Do you have any suggestions for how to remedy it as an economist? And going forward, how do you view the prudence of offering something like a cashable tax credit?
Mr. Chairman, as you know, the oil tax credit system in Alaska is a complicated system of, well, depending on how you count, 15 to 20 different programs, and the various programs have sub-pieces that apply north of 68, south of 68, and to producers of varying sizes. So it's a very complicated system. Which has evolved over time in response to a variety of, I think, at specific times, various of these kinds of tax credits have emerged. So it's a very complicated system that we have. It interacts with both our, and I guess the other piece is, it clearly interacts with the system of how we collect our benefits from those oil reserves that I talked about earlier. And the issue of, I know that the legislature has seen studies from a variety of sources talking about, given the nature of the tax scheme that we run, what is the appropriate way to participate, because that's what tax credits do. And And this is not an area of specialty for me, but so I'm going to oversimplify it a bit. But this kind of an argument that says if you're going to get 30% of the profits, you might invest 30%. And in some sense, that is approximately what I'm wanting to say is what tax credits do. You might think of them as trying to accomplish that in some way. But we are at where we're at, and it seems to me that resolving the question of the oil and gas credits is an important piece of moving forward from a fiscal point of view for, I think, three reasons. The first one is the inherent complexity of it, that it simply makes it hard for many people to understand and make decisions about our process, including the people who are have various of these credits that have been available and who's affected and so forth. So I think the sheer complexity speaks to asking ourselves whether it would make sense to resolve it into a system that has the appropriate incentives going ahead. That would be something that you could do at your leisure, as it were, if it weren't for the immediate issues that you've identified. And the two immediate issues are the state created some expectations. And in terms of being a partner, having people feel that your expectations you've created can be met is important. So it's part of that resolution. But the last piece is, of course, that the oil and gas credits, when they became cashable, moved from being what we think of as traditional credit, that is, they reduced our tax revenues, they moved over onto the expenditure side of the budget. And that has created some real problems for the current fiscal situation because the size of those is very large at present relative to the revenue that's coming in from the oil industry. So I think all of those, it's a knotty problem, but it strikes me that in terms of moving ahead and managing our future assets, that is one of the issues that absolutely needs to be resolved, because leaving it unresolved both leaves the operators in uncertainty, but also means year after year it's back as part of the context when you look at the governor's budget. How much is the governor proposing for oil and gas credits? How much does the legislature want to propose? And how does that affect other spending and the possibility of taxes?
Senator Cochran.
Thank you. I was looking forward to more something I could really get my hand on. But, no, I think that, you know, that's totally appropriate. It's a management problem that I think we have to keep our word, in my view. But thank you for coming before us. One of the things that that we get to do, I like what your staff come up with on those four. That's excellent. But we also are a big geography. And in this geography are several different economies. And the impact of those several different economies is significant. So our productive capacity on a local level has a huge impact on what we do on managing those four assets. Private property is at a minimal, and therefore our infrastructure has a big impact. But even if it's a military economy, if it's a mining economy, if it's a fishing economy, or quite frankly, there are some places that have no cash economy. And so I've always said there are at least five major economies in Alaska, and I think of them both kind of regionally, but there's probably 24 different economies in Alaska if you could categorize them even in 24. So based on that, managing our assets but asking them to participate then becomes really complex. So have you and ICER looked at the productive pods in Alaska that would carry the weight of a cash economy and what the impact of our managing our assets or our taking assets out of that by way of taxing would impact them? Because we know we have some cash economies, some because of federal spending, for example, a lot of cash flow in Fairbanks area based on the payroll. We really appreciate it. I get Walmart because of that, right? But there are some places that that don't. So have you had a chance to categorize those as an ICER economic look?
Well, interestingly, the same staff member who said that I should emphasize the need to think about managing our assets, is that's Professor Gottabi, has really strived to some work specifically on the impact on local governments. Because, as he noted when he was at Labor and Commerce, what's perhaps a bit surprising is that local government employment had not been very directly impacted through certainly through 15 and even into 16. And given the changes that are going on, it seems to him inevitable that there will be more impact as the economy declines on these local governments. And so one of the things that he is trying to put some emphasis, put more analysis into, is these local economies, and absolutely this is an interest of his. On the other hand, he's inherently limited by the nature of the data that we have. As you get to smaller communities, the nature of the data, that it's much easier to get data about Alaska than it is to get data about particular areas. And when you rely on, for example, the Consumer Expenditure Survey to pick a national, it's just a sample, Anchorage is fine. When you get out into the surrounding communities, you don't get especially good estimates, and consequently you end up aggregating well above, unfortunately, 24 economies and trying to do it at a level where you can understand part of what is going on. There are some slight advantages in Alaska. The Permanent Fund generates data about residents and non-residents that we don't get elsewhere in other states, so there's a little bit of data there. And that can be tied, although it's not easy to do, in some cases can be tied to income tax, federal income tax data, to get some sense about what's going on in communities. But your point about that we're going to see differential impacts in different parts of the state as we play through the current economic downturn is absolutely right. And yes, we're trying to work on it. And we will see, to some extent, I guess I'll say, we will see some, after all, this is not magic. We will see if Fairbanks gets an increase in military spending, that the Fairbanks economy will do better. Now, we can put a number on it, perhaps a little more than just saying that's what's going to happen. On the other hand, in the areas of the state where the only two substantial sources of outside cash are from the government, through government employment of various kinds, and through the PFD, and much of the rest of the economy is subsistence, you can also predict that reductions in government spending, reductions in the PFD, will have a disproportionate effect there as compared to the urban centers that have a much more diversified economy. So we will be trying to quantify some of those things at a level that I think at least provides a better understanding of the magnitude of the changes we're going to see.
What might help us is we have some places that are very productive. I hear Bristol, they talk about the fish production. We need to know what that economy looks like so that, because what we do here is we look at subsidies for a lot of different things, whether it's power cost equalization or whatever enhancement it is. And infrastructure really hasn't really hit the level of considering itself a subsidy, but there are a lot of cash subsidies. So those are going to be going down simultaneously where we're going to look for communities to put in more. And that is a yin-yang that is going to be very difficult for us to grasp. So I think it would be wise for us to have an idea of what is the most productive parts of our economy so it will at least have some impact idea. Because if we can't cross-subsidize and they're not productive, then they're going into the dark hole of insolvency. And some of the decisions we make here just haunt us in that if we do one thing, we're going to send some people into that kind of insolvency despair. So just as we look at it, it's one size doesn't fit all very well here. And so if we knew what the productive parts of our society were and where the cross-subsidies were, if we could look at them in that kind of a matrix, then maybe our decisions on if we did a broad-based tax, who bears the weight, maybe the subsidy disappears because of that. Who knows? You know, so those are the things that we're looking at, and they're very dynamic down here, obviously, because they're changing every year. But I think having an idea of the productive parts of our economy in Alaska, we all represent them, but we don't know them in context, I don't think. I mean, we know the oil field, but I don't understand if the fishing industry is a vibrant cash flow industry or if it's a break-even industry, and I think we've been on both counts. But so those kind of things, as an economist, as we look at a broad-based tax then, the impact of that could be dramatic without us even realizing it. So I'm just giving you an idea of how I feel that geography has such a big impact on what we do here.
And I hope we're able to provide the nature of the information that you deal with at the very micro level inherently limits your ability to say this small village is going to have that impact. But I certainly think in terms of being able to aggregate at a level of understanding rural areas that, for example, don't have mines available, the North Slope, and obviously the Rail Belt region, there's going to be some capacity to distinguish how this recession has already played out. There's some data out there, but also how it's likely to continue to play out.
Maybe I was just more expressing my frustration of how a broad-based thing just is so hard to implement.
Dr. Townsend, one of my favorite topics is the PFD. And one of the reasons for that is part of the research that ICER's done on it With a $700 million, or roughly $700 million reduction in the PFD, correct me if I'm wrong, but it impacts the folks with the lowest income. And most of those folks, or many of those folks, or a larger percentage of those folks, correct me if I'm wrong, would spend their money in Alaska to begin with. Is that accurate?
It's accurate to the extent that they spend it in Alaska. The question is, are they spending it in Alaska? And this is the piece that's a little hard. Are they spending it in Alaska on things that are produced externally? That is, are the things at the grocery store that they're buying likely to be things that were shipped in from out of state? Are they likely to be things that would have had some processing here? That's the first of those is relatively easy to verify. The second requires a much more detailed knowledge of expenditures, but also a much more detailed knowledge of our economy. I can say that I think there's little question that Alaska has today has more retail infrastructure than it had 50 years ago. So the impacts, so more of that induced income effects stay in Alaska. But it's still a pretty open economy. That is, we bring in a lot of the resources that you and I buy at the store every day. And that would be true for a very large part of Alaska.
I just wanted to challenge the chairman's premise, and maybe you can help me on that challenge. I think there's no doubt in our mind that regressive says the poorest income. But I think one of the biggest impacts to the reduction in dividend is really to families who are carrying an economic load just outside of the poverty level, because their discretionary cash is a whole lot lower if they're paying for their health care, their car costs, their mortgage, their kids' programs. So I would at least internally, I challenge that impact, because I know several people who get state subsidy issues that have more discretionary cash than many people earn $50,000 a year. So I would think that the impact spread across those two groups is almost equal.
It is true that there are programs and that where the qualification is based on income levels. That, however, is a lot less true than it was 30 or 40 years ago. But 30 or 40 years ago, there used to be a cutoff at some number. And today, many of those, simply because of the issue you're raising, many of those programs have been changed, so their eligibility is phased in and out. And so consequently, that kind of, if I earn $40,000, I'm eligible for nothing, is much less the case than it was when many of these programs were first introduced, that people are eligible for food stamps would be an example. The amount of food stamps you're eligible for depends upon your level of income. So it's phased, essentially phased out as your income goes up. But there are still situations where, and it's particularly health care, where people face large health care costs, and those health care costs will be carried by a particular program based on their income. And people choose not to be, particularly people with, the very expensive programs that renal dialysis. And again, the federal government tried to address that by having a special program for renal dialysis so that one could qualify for the program and still work.
And I've seen it dramatically in my neck of the woods, where almost a 60% raise in health care costs with a 30% raise in medical care, energy costs, without any subsidies, just nearly broke many of the middle-income people to the starvation point. So that's why I say, in my area, I've seen it in a huge, dramatic way. So anyway, that's why I was challenging the premise, but your point is well taken.
Senator Wilson.
No, I'm good.
Okay. So I don't know where the town goes, Doctor. I mean, we're just scratching the surface here. So you're probably going to get a call to either come back, or we're going to devote a whole session to you online. I have an ICER summary that you shared with me that was dated March 16th that has some very valuable information in it. But before we go, the I think I'll save it because I don't want to be seen as gaming the system here. Where I'm going with this is, you know, part of my journey on this whole restoration of the PFD. Part of it was when we got out of the special session, I actually went to businesses and asked them how are things going, and they weren't many of the businesses I talked to, four wheelers, snow machines, boats, Alaskana type of things. They weren't doing very well. And I asked them, it's all anecdotal, I wasn't researching, I said, well, what do you attribute this to? They said, well, a number of our oil company folks have been laid off, and they've pulled back on their spending, and then it was, you know, we gear up for the dividend, and we've just gotten word that the dividend is going to be cut in half. And your research has talked about how the folks with the lowest income, it's a greater impact upon them because it's a greater percentage of their income. Well, what I'm trying to understand is when I'm talking to folks that have a higher income and they tell me that they don't miss the dividend, they just won't go, and I'm not trying to be silly, they just won't go to Vegas or they won't go to Hawaii or they won't, you know, they won't do this or they won't do that. What they weren't going to do was a little different than the folks at the lower rung of the economic ladder. Those folks are telling me it's going to be, I got to decide now between fuel oil, and I have to decide between a four-wheeler that is really our mode of transportation. I have to decide what I'm going to do now how am I going to replace that? That was going to be part of the kids' college tuition. I'm going to have to rethink that. I didn't get the same what I'm not going to do from folks in higher income. So my question is, I'm just trying to ascertain how much of the dividend, the $700 million being taken out of our economy, how much of that really impacted the Alaska economy? Sure, you go to the store and you buy nothing's made. There's no Nabisco plant here. There's no, you know, there's a lot of things. Most things we don't make here in Alaska. We're an export economy. But I'm just trying to find out. It seemed to me anecdotally that business after business after business I talked to that sold to Alaskans were hurting, and it was a combination of the layoff in the oil patch, and it was also they felt it was their words. The halving of the dividend. Do you have any thoughts?
The $700 million, the rough figure we're talking about here, it clearly has a significant impact on the economy. If we had $700 million, it would have, if there had been $700 million additional put into the economy last year, it would have meant that the level of the recession would have been moderated significantly. I think the numbers were that it would be 3,000 or 4,000 jobs difference, very significant. Let me say that one thing that you have to be just a little bit careful on the dividend is that although it's all paid out in a given year, the impact is not necessarily felt in that year. And let me give a simple example. If I was considering buying a four-wheeler and there was a sale in August, I might have bought the four-wheeler, thinking I know how I'm going to pay for it, right? And then, so what I'm saying is people do not make their plans based entirely on, oh, when it gets here in October, people are anticipating it. So some of the plans during the year may have been different, and people looking ahead, we may continue to see the impact as they say, oh, should I be expecting a smaller dividend next year? And so I will, in my planning for my budget for the year, I'll be planning on getting $1,000 rather than $2,000, for example. So that is clearly a significant impact. There's no question. The second piece is that, as you alluded, the distribution is such that the percentage of income that it represents for people earning $20,000 is very high. The percentage that it represents for people earning $200,000 is much, much lower, and so they have more discretion to decide, will I use that for spending out of state? Will I save it? You know, will I put it towards my child's college sort of fund? They have choices at that level that someone earning $20,000 does not have. So, and ISA has done a study that showed that the impact on poverty of the dividend has been probably an impact of around 25% reduction in poverty, again, measured against the particular federal line. You can quibble about whether that line is right for Alaska, but still it says there was a substantial impact. You would have expected that number. You would have said yes. And I'd say that because, Senator, I think you and I discussed this at one point. In a certain sense, the dividend program ends up operating like programs that used to be common in Europe, that every family in Europe received a certain amount of income from the state based on the family size. I have to admit, let me tell you how pervasive those programs are. I was in Iceland for 6 months, and I had two small children, and I got a check. I couldn't tell what it said because it was written in Icelandic, so I went to the office. And they said, oh, that's your family dividend check for this quarter. Oh, they didn't call it this is your family check. That was, by that point, it was relatively small because it had been reduced by inflation, to be honest. But it was striking that, from their perspective, the fact that we registered, we had to get the equivalent of a Social Security number. We weren't residents. They knew that. But they provided it to all children in Iceland as an across-the-board kind of program. Those kinds of across-the-board programs are particularly common in the Scandinavian countries, but were in many cases common across Europe. They were not; those are not the way social programs have been run in the United States. So Alaska is in a really unique situation of being able, through the permanent fund, to fund a program that has the kind of impact that countries that provide flat payments to all families or children are able to provide, and taking those programs away in Europe would be seen as having a very negative impact on families, and reducing the permanent fund also has a very negative impact on the lowest income part of Alaskan society.
So you would have never received one in Alaska because you were only in Iceland for 6 months. You'd have to be here for a year.
I have to stay here another year to get the first one. So,
did you move here for the permanent fund dividend?
I did not. In fact, I
because that is the word that no, not that you moved here for the permanent fund dividend, but that and I don't know if
and I didn't get married just so my wife would call in May just so my
and
wife
I don't
would
know
qualify.
If there's any you may be doing research in the future, but that is a statement that I hear a lot is that people have moved here for the dividend. I asked them. Do they know what it costs to move here, A, and B, do they move here and wait for a year to get the dividend? I don't know if there's any research on that.
You'd have to go to the homeless shelter to do that.
There's so much to ask.
Well, actually, I think it's a point that when people, particularly people like myself, decide to move, they sit down and say, yes, I'm going to spend $20,000 to get all my stuff to Alaska or something like that. How much is my income going to go up? And calculations like, in my case, I certainly did a little bit of arithmetic. I don't know whether I did the dividend. It was much more important for me, quite honestly, that I'm not paying Social Security as a state employee, you'll recall. And so the effective income tax, because the Social Security is essentially an income tax, the effective income tax rate on me was substantially lower because I'm not paying the Social Security rate. And so in looking at my income, I certainly said, well, there's 7% more in the take-home. And I think for people at $50,000 or $80,000, the calculation is the dividend going to put $4,000 or $8,000 into my pocket is not an irrelevant calculation. They have to recover you have to recover the costs of the move over some reasonable number of years to make it worthwhile. So I wouldn't say that it's irrelevant, but my point being it is expensive to move here and it would be one of many calculations, and Alaska is different in many ways, including things like the higher cost of living. At least in my case, I sit there and say, well, and then there's the cost of 4 to 6 airplane tickets a year to go see all of those things go in. The dividend may be a piece of it, but it certainly doesn't, for the vast majority of people, I doubt that it dominates that because there are so many other factors.
So we're gonna wrap it up. We've gotten 10 minutes over. We'll probably set another meeting up solely with yourself. I still have a tremendous number of questions based upon the summary and the research that you put together because we need the data so that we can make some sound decisions. So with that, thanks for coming again. Thanks for speaking with us. We'll have you back. With that, we are going to adjourn.